what I'm going to do in the final half hour is talk about essentially the project. So I handed out earlier the assignment, and I recommend you get a copy of that. I have it projected, because you probably will want to make some notes on it. Now, are there any extras back there? I know at least one person was lacking a copy. I thought I counted enough. Okay. So we're going to use exactly the structure that I showed earlier in the previous segment. Namely, we're going to use productions that begin with program. And what I'll first do is kind of walk you through what these productions are and basically what they mean. In some cases, it's obvious and some not. And again, in a couple of spots, you're going to want to make little notes to yourself, because there are a couple of spots where there are gotchas or things that possibly bother you. So in this particular language, it looks a lot like Java. So we start out with program. That's the start symbol. All programs will start out with rule one. That means, in our case, we're doing a class. And of course, that's what Java does too, is they compile on a class-by-class basis. So we'll start a class, and a class will have a name that's an identifier. We could try to have, like other languages do, uppercase versus lowercase conventions. The language is not going to enforce that. That would be a convention. So you have an identifier, and inside braces, again like Java, you have the members of the class. Members are fields and methods. Now, productions 2 and 3, the member decals. If you've got a paper, a pen, or a pencil, mark productions 2 or 3 and say, this is right, this is what I wanted. As you're going to start looking at that, you're going to say, hey, this guy's crazy. Why did he write that down? He couldn't possibly mean what he said, but he did. And let me just explain. I mean, it's not really gobbledygook. What it's saying in this particular case, we have fields and methods. To keep life reasonably simple, and a lot of people do that as convention, we're going to have all our fields in the class come first. Fields kind of act as global variables, quote unquote, in the sense they're accessible to all the methods that are in the class. We'll be compiling one class at a time, so there's no issue about importing fields or methods from other classes, except for the ones that are in libraries. So it says that member decals can have zero or more fields. That's production number 2. Every time I want a field, I use production 2, and I repeat it if I want 2 fields, 3 fields, and so on. It's perfectly legal for me to have a class that has no fields at all. Think of the traditional hello world. That's usually a class that has a single method, usually main, and it has a single print statement saying hello world. Don't need any fields, so there's a case where you don't need them. Following the fields, we use production number 3 to go to methods, and methods generate 0 or more methods. Our syntax allows 0 methods, but in practice, that would not be a valid program, because we're going to have a rule, just like Java, that every class must have a main method. Why? Well, that's how you start executing. Where do I start executing? I could have the rule that an empty class does absolutely nothing, but aside from showing you know, that that's an anomaly that exists, who cares? You don't write programs to do absolutely nothing. So I could allow it, but I can't really see any advantage to it. So syntactically, it doesn't say no, but when we get around to implementing it, you have to have at least a main method to do anything. So that's what those two productions are doing. We get around to something that looks odd, a couple of lines down there, namely something called optional semi. That stands for optional semicolon, and there's a use of a lambda. The reason for that is, if you look down below, is that in methods, we have a variety of forms of methods. Essentially, we can have a void method. You're familiar with those. That's essentially a subprogram that doesn't return a value. It can take 0 parameters, or it can take 1 or more parameters. 2 different choices there. Or you can have a typed method that's usually called a function. And in that case, it's going to have 0 arguments or more. And inside the body, I can have some fields. Those are essentially locals to the method, and some statements. And then I have an optional semi. And why is that? Well, again, the world kind of divides into groups of people that when you write a method, you write the closed brace, and you're done. But other people love to put semicolons at the end of things. There's a semicolon at the end of a field declaration. There's a semicolon at the end of a statement. Why can't we put them at the end of a method? And the answer is yes, you can. So optional semi says, if you care to put a semicolon, go ahead and do it. It's not going to change the meaning of the program because the right brace essentially does the same thing. But if you like to type them, you can do it. So that's intentionally in there as an example of how we change grammars to be a tad more user-friendly. If a person is going to do something and it's not really a terrible crime and it's clear what the person means, you can allow it. So that's the explanation there. Sliding down a bit more, we have arguments that are typed. What would you imagine those empty square brackets in an argument mean? Something very similar in Java, and what do they mean there? Array. So it means not only are we going to have arrays, that's down a little bit further, but we're going to have arrays that are parameters. That's important because arrays are a very valuable data structure. And again, we want to have the language be realistic enough you can do real computations. And surely having arrays is something that is pretty fundamental. If we go down the fields, fields are either fields at the class level or fields in the local method or in an int block. We have, it's typed, it has an identifier and a semicolon. If I want, I can have an optional initializer. So just like in Java, if I declare a field, I can initialize it to zero or false or a character value or whatever I want. I can have an array. And in this simple language, the arrays are always integer literals. So some languages allow, but ours doesn't, to say, give me an array and I'll compute the value in advance. That's simply to make life a little easier for you. So old-fashioned languages had fixed-size arrays. A more realistic language would have something more flexible. If you're interested in extra credit, it's not too hard to generalize this to something that allows expressions. When you have expressions, you've got to be sure, of course, the expression is well-founded and something like that when we talk about scoping. But that'd certainly be a possibility. And we have something at the very bottom line that sometimes confuses people, namely, how do we do constants? Now, of course, in Java, they make things final. And, okay, I can understand that, but to me, there's variables and constants. So in this particular case, if we want a constant, you say, give me a constant, and you give it, of course, an initializer. But there's something odd about constants, namely, they don't have a type in the declaration. And why is that? Well, I really don't need one, do I? Because the expression itself is going to have a type, and whatever the type of the expression is, the constant is equal to it in the very strict sense, equal because constants cannot be changed. So if I had something that was a Boolean expression, then the identifier would be of type Boolean or character or whatever else we had. So just doing that is, I could put the type in there, but you'd have to check it, but it seems a little bit redundant to say, here's the type of something when I just gave you what it's equal to. So our rule is the type of the identifier is whatever the type of the expression is. And again, just to give you a flavor of that sort of thing. So notice we have quite a bit of language there. We have methods, we have fields, we have locals, we have arrays. Haven't gotten to expressions yet. That's the next page. Oh, we got statements first. That's cool. So statements, just as I showed you earlier, is a list of zero or more statements. So looking at this thing here, can I have a list of zero statements if I want to? And the answer is yes, because the second line says lambda. So when it says you have to have statements, it really means you may have statements. And the question is, why would you want to have statements and not have any at all? Well, if you look down towards the bottom, is one of the statements I have, the very last one, is a block. A block is a left brace, a right brace, with fields and statements. And it may be in a particular case that I wanted to have essentially a block that has absolutely nothing in it. Why would you want to have a block that has absolutely nothing in it? Well, suppose I had a then part or an else part of the body of a loop that I intentionally wanted to put nothing in it, but I didn't want to confuse the reader. If, for example, I said if and the then part had absolutely nothing at all, there's an ambiguity of did he forget to type something in or what? If I say if expression and then the body of the then is an empty block, he said, okay, he's got a then part, but he's doing nothing at all. Maybe in this case, the else does all the cool stuff and the then just leaves well enough alone. So that's the intentional why it's in there. Again, there's design decisions that kind of get their way into the language and into the syntax. So that's an explanation of that. Let's look at the statements. Okay, if you got your pencil or pen there, take the first two statements, the if statements, the if then and if then else. Those two statements are going to give you a little problem until you fix them, because there's an error. Not a bad error, but an error, namely that those two statements are ambiguous. Remember, I just got done maybe a half hour ago preaching about how bad ambiguity was. But historically, it turns out that the grammars for if then and if then else have an ambiguity in there that has to be fixed. Now, one way to fix it would be to change the actual structure of the if. But ifs are pretty well standardized. If you think of if, you go back all the way to C or C++ or Java. Ifs look pretty much the same. If, parens, a statement, and optionally an else followed by a statement. But where's the ambiguity? Let me go and show you and explain how it's fixed. So if, for example, I have, oops, don't want that. I say if A, then if B, A gets 1, else B gets 2. And please forgive the fact that I should have Booleans and not integers there. Okay, that's a valid statement. But under the grammar I gave you, there's two possible interpretations, and the interpretations differ in terms of the actual effect. So, can anybody tell me one interpretation of what this means? Well, what it really boils down to is there's one else and two ifs. And the differentiation is which if does the else associate with? So one interpretation is, and I'll draw it in the top, it says, if A is true, then do the if statement that's inside that bracket. Else, if A is false, B gets 2. That's one interpretation. The other interpretation is, this if has its entire body as an if-then-else statement. And then it means if B is true, A gets 1, else B gets 2. Well, this structure exists in Java. It exists in C, exists in C++. It may even exist in Cache. I don't know. Does it? It's such a different language that I never know whether to stick my head out or not. But those are very fundamental. There are two different interpretations because the choice of when the else is executed would be controlled either by A or by B. Java, C, C++, and virtually all other languages have an extra rule that says, in this case, here's how to resolve the ambiguity. One interpretation wins, the other loses. Does anybody remember which the interpretation is? Say louder. Closest. The rule is always the else associates with the nearest unmatched if. That means this one right there is correct. And that means when we get around to actually getting the parser done, we're going to have to change the grammar I showed you a moment ago. Let's go back to it. A little bit. And there's a couple of ways of doing it. It's not as bad as it seems. But let me warn you, because the parser, unless you give it a very special incantation, will not generate a parser. I should say the parser generator will not generate a parser if there are ambiguities. What I recommend initially is that you pull one of the if then else out. So for example, if you pull the if expr out, you're fine. That means all if statements must be the form if then else. But remember I told you a moment ago, you can use an empty pair of braces to hold the place if you don't want anything done as a then or an else. That's only a temporary expedient if you pull one or the other out. Obviously, if you pull the else out, you can't have any else statements. If you pull the if out, then every if statement is going to have a then part and an else part, which means you might have to write if something, then something interesting, else, the empty block. It's only temporary, but that will allow your parser to find a valid, unambiguous grammar and generate a parser from it. So one of the gotchas you got is you're going to have to kind of do penance for the sins of your elders, your predecessors, in that they designed a bad language design, and you and lots of other parser implementers are going to have to find a way to fix it. And it turns out there are two ways. One is to change the grammar somewhat, and the other is there's a way of telling it, and and I'll explain that to you a little later, not today, but in a later lecture, telling it even though there's an error, go ahead and accept the erroneous structure under the following interpretation. And the interpretation would, in fact, be that the else associates with the nearest unmatched if. So that means that the fourth production down would take precedence over the third. Sounds a little confusing, but the reason I threw it in there is when you write down grammars, ambiguities sometimes pop up. This is a well-known one, and it's been solved, and it's no big deal. Other times, there's an ambiguity you didn't even realize, and all of a sudden, the parser will not accept the grammar, and you say, oh, here's why, and I have to find some way of allowing one and disallowing another interpretation. Because normally, you don't want an ambiguity. Certainly, we would not, going back to the if-then-else, say, Mr. Parser, you have your choice. You can take the first interpretation or the second, whichever you feel like. That would mean on Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays, a program would do one thing, and Tuesday and Thursdays, it would do another. And if you ever came up with programs like that that don't reproduce their errors, and some of you are probably in quality assurance, and you probably see some of those, it's the worst thing in the world. The guy tells you, it doesn't work, and you try it up, and it works beautifully. You come with this close of saying you're an idiot, you don't know what you're doing, but you can't tell that to customers because they got the money and you want to keep them happy. So you try to explain, you know, I've done it and you've done it and it's part of the business. So let's continue on having that. So we have a while loop. That's perfectly fine. If you want to make plans to include a for loop, somewhere around the while would be something to add the syntax for a loop. If you're not sure about for loop, you can look at the back of any Java book, any C++ book, and it'll show you the exact structure of a for loop. Basically, you remember it's inside the parens you have an initializer, and then the condition, and then an incrementer. And those are in there. And then the body is the same. We have two versions of the while loop because whiles can be labeled. If you have for loops, you'll probably want to label for loops too. And that's because there are break and continue statements that allow you to control or terminate the execution of a loop. So we have in there a while loop labeled or not. We have an assignment. We have increment and decrement, but that's only at the statement level. It's not at the expression level. So that means and as abbreviation for A gets A plus 1, I can say A plus plus. People like to do it, so I've included it in there. That's a cool thing to have, for example, when you have your increment statement in a for loop. Remember, you know, I gets 1 while I is less than 10, I plus plus. So that would allow that sort of thing there. We have read and print, which are obvious there. But notice in this language, to minimize our need to attach other libraries, read and print are built in. In Java, read and print has innumerable variations and they're members of classes. So there's read line and you know, print line, print and print line and all that. In this case, we have a print, but no print line. Oh my God, that's terrible. I love print line. How do you get print line in this simple language? The last thing you add in the things that are listed to be printed is a new line character. And notice what happens is in this case, unlike Java, and this I think is a blessing, you don't have to have this stupid plus sign where you add all the pieces together to make one string because the print only wants to print one string and you've got to build it up. In this case, you can have a list of things to be printed. So you can print A equals and then the value you want printed. And then if you want a new line, you can have, in fact, you can have your choice. I mean, what a wonderful language. You can have the string that contains the new line, or you can have the character that contains a new line. And so a string of length one or a character, and you get your choice. On Monday, Wednesday, and Fridays, you can use one, and Tuesdays and Thursdays, the others. So at any rate, I mean, the situation. We then have going down a little further, after the print and read, we have method calls. So these are method calls at the subroutine level, and this is the case where those methods being called have to be of type void, because in this case, you can't use a return value. Some languages allow a function to be called as a statement. We don't allow that just because I think it leads to more confusion than it's worth. So we have method calls. We may be inside of a method, so we have a return or a return expression. Return expression if we are in a function, return if we're in a procedure. Break and continue are relative to loops. Can anybody remind me what the difference is? If I'm in a loop and I break, what happens? I get the heck out of the loop. I terminate the loop early. And that's the more common of the two. And what's continue? It says, forget about this iteration, go back to the loop tester and see if I need to do another iteration. So it might be the case that you have a whole list of things, and at some point you have a very simple case where you don't have to do much. You say continue, and that takes you to the next element in the loop. So if you're doing a list of array elements, sometimes you have to do full processing, sometimes not. That's not my invention. That's standard Java, but they exist. And my language, you know, just like Java, has something that old-timers really find very worrisome. Namely, it has no go-tos and no labels as a target of go-tos. There's nothing in the language that says you go to here or go to there. Java had the same rule, and for a long while, people thought that was horrible. But now people don't really seem to miss it very much. Historically, misuse of go-tos is terrible. Again, does cache have go-tos? Excuse me? Yeah. So any of you done that, you may have seen some code that's go to here, go to there, and they call it sometimes called spaghetti bowl because it's following loops, you know, spaghetti from one end to the other. So at any rate, that's not to attack cache. It's just simply to get the history of what it is. Early languages always had go-tos, so it's just a matter at some point of deciding that certain things are more dangerous than they are. In fact, we were talking about whether or not some of you get into some classes require C or C++ rather than Java. And I was talking to a fellow instructor. He says, oh, yeah, everybody ought to use C and C++, so they have the great fun of doing core dumps and doing memory collection and having memory leaks and all the other stuff that C and C++ allow that Java has disallowed. But it's really the case at some point we as designers have to say these things are so dangerous, you may not have them. And it's kind of a hard thing because we're not the masters of the universe. We're just trying to decide what's acceptable and what's not. So it's always a big thing in society. What should you allow and disallow? One man's virtue is another man's vice, as the saying goes, and it's hard to do it. But you will see bits of that here and there where the consensus seems to be this is way too dangerous or unneeded or whatever, and the language evolves. And who knows what it'll be 100 years from now. It may be very different and so on. I hope I'm still not teaching the class then in the old style way. We have types. The types are pretty familiar in char and bool. I did not put float in because numbers are numbers and it gets kind of get confusing, and a real language would certainly want it, but our language doesn't need it. We have parameters. We have a read list, write list. Oh, here we get to expressions. And look at how much stuff we have in expressions. So starting right about there. Guess what, though? You have to change virtually none of that. The reason this is as verbose as it is this is embedding all the operator precedence rules that the language has. So this is doing what I showed you earlier, namely, it's enforcing the fact that if I have a multiply and an addition in an expression, multiply comes first. It turns out the way this thing works is a situation there that the lowest priority operators come first. So and or have the very lowest priority. And that kind of makes sense, because if I say A equal 1 and B equal 2 in an expression, what would you expect that this means in terms of just plain English? What is this telling the computer to do? It's saying, please go ahead and compare A against 1, get a Boolean. Please compare B against 2, get a Boolean, and then and them together. But notice if I didn't have the right operator precedence, I'd have something like this. And look what that fool would try to do. If I did strictly left to right, for example, without operator precedence, it would compare the A against 1, that's fine, and would and in a B. But in my notion there, B is probably not a Boolean, it's probably an integer, and therefore I get a type error, and would say type error, and say, what, no type error? I'm just trying to compare two things and them together. So the operator precedence tries to set up what the most likely usage is. Again, you always have parentheses if you want to force a different grouping. So the and or come first, then come the relational operators, then come the plus, then comes the star and slash, and finally comes unary operators, which is the not and the typecast. And the lower you are in the hierarchy, the higher the precedence is. Finally, at the bottom, we have the elementary items. We have a name, And I'll show you, that's the next page. A name is essentially a possibly substricted identifier. The ID with parens in the unit there are function calls. Int lid is, of course, an integer literal. We have a character lid, a string lid. True and false are Boolean constants. Remember, that those are reserved words, and now you know why we had those. I have a parenthesized expression, and the name is an identifier, possibly with a subscripted expression. So a name is either a subscripted value or a non-array value. And that's essentially the language in terms of what's in there. Again, there's a lot of detail, but we'll work on that. Any questions on what's in the language or why something is missing or anything like that? So I got just a few minutes, and let me say how we're going to get this started. And what we're going to do is give you a head start. So let me go down towards the bottom of the handout. Right here. So what we're doing is we're actually giving you a working parser, soup to nuts, including a scanner. We give the scanner, but this is simple enough. You could also use your own scanner. You will need to use your scanner when you do the full language. But this is something that looks kind of similar to CSX. This is CSX Lite. And one way to get started is to take this, which we've given you in full detail, and very similar to what you did when you're doing the scanner, start adding a few simple things. So in this case, for example, we have plus, minus, double equal, and not equal. There's way more operators. You could certainly add those in. I didn't add them in because I had enough to give you the flavor and let you do the rest. We have a couple of statements here, like an assignment and an if. There's no reason why you couldn't add a while loop, for example. And we don't have anything down in units about arrays. You could add subscripting and arrays. At some point, however, you're going to have to make a transition. Now, when you were youngsters, when you're first learning to ride a bike, how many of you had training wheels? Yeah, they still have them. I had training wheels. And they were cool because they're training wheels, you know, you could kind of go along. And, of course, the cool thing about training wheels is you never tipped. Well, at some stage, this is the bike with training wheels. And at some stage, you're going to have to take the training wheels off, and you know what happens then. If you don't, you know, you don't stop right or you don't pedal fast enough, you tip. And that's not so good. So the reason I'm saying that is notice that as we get higher into the structure, there are no methods. CSS Lite does not have methods, and there's no class. This is a language that ain't got no class. Okay, so in this particular case, so statements can be extended, expressions can be extended, declarations can be extended, but at some point, you're going to have to say, I'm no longer going to stay in the rules of CSX Lite, where a program does not begin with a class. Let me finish my thought, and we're out of here. So at some stage, you're going to say, I've done a lot of it, I got the feeling of it, and I'm going to take those training wheels off, and I'm going to stop making a CSX Lite program, I'm going to make a CSX program, which means at the root, I'm not going to have a CSX Lite node, I'm going to have a class node. And all my statements are not going to be inside a block, they're going to be inside a method, because that's what Java does and that's what CSX does. So at some stage, you're going to have to make the transition. That's not a big deal. As long as you started putting enough stuff in, you understand what's going on, that's fine. All the stuff you put in, like while loops and extra operators and so on, carries forward. You don't have to change any of that. It's not throwaway work. But just be warned that at some stage, you're going to have to go. And what will happen is if you're at the point where you're making the changes, if you test with the wrong language, you're going to get bogus syntax errors. So if, for example, you took a CSX Lite and gave a CSX program that began with class, you're going to get a syntax error because there is no class in CSX. Similarly, if you make the change over to CSX and you have a program that doesn't begin with class, because notice CSX Lite begins with a left brace, you're going to get a syntax error. So this is the notion of taking the training wheels off and going to the full language. But this is still a great way to start. I'll be talking next time about CUP and all the rest. And a good way to start is just add a few productions, make them run, and add a few more and a few more and take it from there. So I think it's a nice incremental way of doing it. So we'll see you next week. And for the gentleman in the back, we now have...